This is Bulwaga Bay. It provided protection for Burgoyne's boats that had gathered here to prepare for their assault on Ticonderoga.
Oh, weird. From the aerial image on my phone, the land kind of curls around like a thumb. It seems like they would be really protected here.
Yes, I guess it does kind of look like a thumb. That's what we're about to turn onto, the thumb part. Each time the soldiers set up camps, the first troops to arrive set to work building ovens to bake bread for the arriving troops.
We found the masons and bakers who had been detached the day before yesterday. They had built a baker's oven, and bread will be baked tomorrow. What joy! After all, we had not eaten anything but biscuit that was hard as rock.
So they are unloading their stuff in the bay and feeling pretty confident.
Yes, but look behind us. What do you see?
You mean up there? Those ledges?
Precisely. These hills and rock outcrops also provide a position for the rebels to harass their approaching enemy. The bay is about a mile wide, so I doubt that they would be able to fire quite so far as the end of the peninsula, but they certainly could observe the movement of Burgoyne's troops and harass the soldiers that rode into the broad bay.
Out on the end of that peninsula? That would be a great place for a fort.
How did you know that there was a fort there?
Well, you have this pretty calm and broad bay for gathering your boats. This jutting peninsula of flat land that can't be easily reached by gunfire from the hills above. And there's a bridge ahead, so the crossing must be narrow. Plus, there was a sign back there with an arrow saying Crown Point State Historic Site.
Very funny, Marshal. But you're absolutely right. This was actually the site of two former forts. French Fort St. Frederick and British Fort Crown Point. And in all its known history, this place has never been the scene of a battle.
Why not?
Fort St. Frederick was constructed by the French in the 1730s.
Before the French and Indian War?
Yes, it was made of stone to replace a wooden stockade fort, constructed also by the French across the lake at Chimney Point.
Sounds like the Three Little Pigs. Are you going to tell me that earlier they had made one of straw?
Very funny. Fort St. Frederick occupied a strategic position between French Canada and Britain's American colonies. Ignoring the Treaty of Utrecht that we talked about back there at Split Rock, this fort encroached on British territory.
So the French violated their agreement?
Right. The French wanted to thumb their noses at the British. They used Crown Point as a base of operations for French raids into New York and New England, and as a safeguard against British encroachment.
You mean they grabbed it before the British could?
Well, yes. But the French actively encouraged the settlement of Crown Point and Chimney Point on the opposite side of the lake. With a garrison of about 120 men at the fort, the threat of a British attack was considered remote.
So when did the British get it and name it Crown Point?
Well, the year after the legendary defeat of the British at Fort Carillon in 1758, aka Fort Ticonderoga, the British were back on top. In 1759, New France was dealing with losses elsewhere and had left their stone garrison ill-equipped. The French abandoned and destroyed Fort St. Frederick during their retreat to prevent it from falling into British hands. That same year, the British constructed the larger Crown Point at a higher vantage point.
What about the French Canadians who had started to settle here?
It's not really clear. Without protection, many probably left. But some could have stayed. After the French and Indian War, the French land grants on Lake Champlain were redistributed to British soldiers.
Wait a minute. If the British drove the French Canadians from their homes, why would they ally with the British rather than the Americans?
The French distrusted the American colonists. There was a real cultural and religious clash going on here. In 1774, the British Parliament passed the Quebec Act. That guaranteed the French Canadians their language, religious freedom, and French civil law. In return, the French Canadians were expected to swear allegiance to the British Crown.
Okay, so then the Brits built Crown Point.
Yep, a little north and east of the original. As we drive up the road, you can see that the French fort is identified with a white flag, the British fort by a British flag. And when Burgoyne and his soldiers anchored here, it looked pretty much like this. But probably all cleared of trees.
But if this fort was never the scene of a battle, why is it in ruins?
After the construction of Fort Crown Point, there was just a skeleton crew to maintain the fort. In 1773, army wives accidentally ignited a chimney fire. The wind blew the sparks to the powder magazine.
Pow!
Exactly. A British engineer did inspect the fort and plans were made for its repair, but the revolution started before construction could begin. On May 15, 1775, a week after taking Fort Ticonderoga, Benedict Arnold and Ethan Allen captured Fort Crown Point, which was manned by a skeletal crew of British soldiers. Despite being in ruins, in the next few years, both the Americans and the British vied for it as a staging ground. Do you remember when Arnold retreated from Canada in 1776, he burnt the outbuildings, which prevented Carleton from maintaining his position here later that same year?
Oh yeah, I guess location was strategic with or without the fort.
Right. And now Burgoyne was here using Crown Point as a rendezvous point for his army. Crown Point, along with Chimney Point, across the lake became the size of a modern city. Nearly 14,000 people all gathered here in tents and ruins of the burnt-out homes.
Whoa, I kind of see it, a whole city of tents right here.
It is a rather pleasant place, and while it was all built up, it was bigger than the city of Braunschweig. Individual houses are still standing here and there, but the largest and best part has been burned down. The fort was also demolished by the enemy. It must have been very beautiful. Inside the fort are three more houses whose wooden parts have all been burned.
As we approach the museum, you can see the replica bread ovens along the entry road. They were definitely happy to have something other than the old hard biscuit and dried salt meat, but it still wasn't exactly the most comfortable stay for the troops.
We are in the midst of a heat wave, and moreover, day and night we are tortured by insects. Last night, we had a very severe thunderstorm, with lightning and heavy thunder, such as I had never experienced in Germany.
Everyone is getting ready for battle.
The army embarks tomorrow to approach the enemy. We are to contend for the king and the constitution of Great Britain to vindicate law and to relieve the oppressed. During our progress, occasion may occur in which not difficulty, nor labor, nor life are to be regarded. This army must not retreat.
So now let's go back and find out how Burgoyne got here in the first place. Okay, you're on, Marshal. Use your device and rustle up some background on our guy, Burgoyne.
Okay, he was born to the family of Captain John Burgoyne, but wait, he was really thought to be the illegitimate child of Lord Bingley, a wealthy aristocrat. And when Lord Bingley died in 1731, he inherited his estate. He had been given a proper military education and was able to purchase an officer's commission. Purchase an officer's commission?
Yes, that was the way they did it in Europe. Ranked positions were reserved for people who could afford it.
Then he eloped with Lady Charlotte, daughter of the Earl of Derby.
Against the Earl's will, I might add.
Ah, so he was rebellious too, like Arnold. Okay, so Burgoyne sold his commission and they moved to France. After the birth of their child, they eventually reconciled with Lord Derby and he was able to purchase a new commission. He then went to Portugal during the Seven Years' War. Do you think he was a good soldier?
Yes, a good leader. Innovative, ambitious, and well-liked by his men.
It says here that he was elected to the House of Commons and Parliament. Get this, he was a playwright and active in British society too.
Yes, quite the bon vivant. He headed off to Boston in 1775.
I guess he had a share of enemies too, because some people called him vain and ambitious.
Burgoyne is a troubled soul. The situation with Carleton in Quebec and his wife's death became a turning point for him. Should he give up on a promotion and retire? Or go for the glory and honor of an experienced military leader? At any rate, it would do nothing for him to remain in Canada for the winter. Here's what Burgoyne had to say.
You will not wonder, my dear friend, at my return to England. A secondary station in a secondary army is at no times agreeable. Many circumstances combine to render it in the present instance uncommonly dissatisfactory. A few duties yet remaining to the memory of Lady Charlotte compel me to break through the bars of ice and snow which are forming to seclude the country from the rest of the globe for the next 6 months. I mean not, however, to withdraw myself from the American war unless a French one breaks out.
Hear that? That's how dicey it is for England and the colonies around the world. They were stretched thin. They had armies around their worldwide empire, and war could erupt anywhere.
My prospects are closed. Interest, ambition of life is over. Profession and honor are all that remains, and I would rather than finished in a professional grave than to slow, wasting decrepitude and infirmness of age.
A professional grave? Does that mean a soldier's grave?
Yes, I think so, because after he tended to the burial of his wife, Lady Charlotte, he spent the next month grieving and pulling himself together. But also, he prepared a plan for the 1777 campaign he called Thoughts for Conducting War from the Side of Canada. It was a three-pronged attack with the aim of severing New England from the remainder of the colonies. It's like what you would do with an infected arm or leg.
Ew, Grandpa!
Well, that's kind of how the British saw the rebellion. An infection that had to be dealt with before it spread. It was a three-pronged attack. Burgoyne's plan. You ready?
Ready.
You see, while Carleton and Burgoyne drove the rebels from Canada in the spring of 1776, British General Sir William Howe had secured New York Harbor. So now the British held the two ends of the waterway that separated New England from the rest of the continent. Prong one. Howe was to come up the Hudson from New York City. Prong 2. Burgoyne leads a contingent down from Canada by the way of the Champlain-Hudson Corridor.
That's why we're here.
Prong 3. Brevetted General St. Leger was to lead the divisionary force from the west by the way of the St. Lawrence and Mohawk Rivers. Burgoyne's plan was not necessarily original or cutting edge, but Burgoyne convinced Lord George Germain, the man who controlled the British strategy in North America. Germain and the king thought that he was the guy with the fire, ambition, and know-how to get it done. You see, wars were expensive, and the king wanted the rebellion put down within the year. Burgoyne's plan was approved.
One question.
What?
What happened to Carleton? I thought he was in charge in Canada.
Oh, it's also diplomatic. Here is a bit of a letter from Lord George Germain to General Sir Guy Carleton.
March 26, 1777. With a view of quelling the rebellion as soon as possible, the security and good government of Canada absolutely requires your presence there. It is the King's determination to leave about 3,000 men under your command for the defense and duties of that province, and to employ the remainder of your army upon two expeditions under the command of Lieutenant General Burgoyne, who is to force his way to Albany, and the other under the command of Lieutenant Colonel St. Leger, who is to make a diversion on the Mohawk River.
Carleton had to stay and rule in Quebec City. He couldn't lead a campaign. The letter went on to specify that Burgoyne and St. Leger act independently until they relieve their command to Howe in Albany.
It is His Majesty's pleasure that they act as exigencies may require, and in such manner as they shall judge most proper for making an impression on the rebels and bringing them to obedience. But that in doing so, they must never lose view of their intended junctions with Sir William Howe as their principal object.
Must never lose their view equals get to Albany by all means necessary.
Grandpa, why are you making such a big deal of that?
Well, here's what Carleton had to say in regard to Germain.
It was the height of arrogance and folly for ministers in London to direct operations of war in a country at 3,000 miles distance, of which they have so little knowledge as not to be able to distinguish between good, bad, or interested advice, or to give positive orders upon matters which from their nature are ever on the change.
Good point. 3,000 miles is a long way away to try to run a war.
Especially when it takes several weeks to cross the ocean.
What about George Washington? Has he crossed the Delaware by now?
Yes, a lot has been going on south of here while Burgoyne is back in London during the winter of 1776-77. General George Washington and the Continental Army pulled off two surprise attacks during the Battle of Princeton and Trenton. On the British side, General Howe has written several letters to Germain outlining different plans for his intentions of the 77 campaign. Howe was going to go after Washington and capture Philadelphia, home to the Continental Congress, after what he believed would be a swift defeat, Howe would then assist Burgoyne.
Howe must be a superhero to win in Philly and get back up the Hudson River to meet Burgoyne in Albany, especially in olden times. Did the guy have a map?
Some kind of map, I'm sure, but I don't know if that meant he could actually perceive the distances or understand the challenges of the geography. Also, I'm not sure Albany was at the top of his list.
I thought you said that Germain was the guy who was calling the shots, not Howe.
Germain approved both Burgoyne's plan to act upon the Hudson River and Howe's plan to act upon Philadelphia.
Pretty wacky, but Burgoyne has the green light to proceed with a plan, right?
Righto! The game is on!